This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Ella Lee of The Hill, I know that you cover courts and justice with a focus on cases about national politics. Your reporting has spanned tons of different legal battles involving, of course, the former president and other political figures. You and I have been able to talk a number of times, not on air, and I'm so excited that you are now joining us on Passing Judgment.
Absolutely. I'm glad to be here.
So the big news, of course, is that the New York hush money payment case is beginning. This is a state criminal trial. It is the first criminal trial that will proceed against a former president in our nation's history. And I think there's some perception that it's the weakest of the trials pending against the former president. Before we dive into the details, is this a case where, in talking to experts, you have a sense that this is going to be very difficult to win?
Yeah, so it really depends on the jury, as with any criminal case. But I think that the district attorney's office does have a bit of an uphill battle here. Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. We'll get into the details later, I'm sure. But baseline, those stem from reimbursements he made to his ex-fixer after arranging a hush money deal with Stormy Daniels. And so he's, of course, pleaded guilty and has denied that affair. And each of those counts are tied to these false records. You know, we have invoices for legal fees, checks reimbursing Cohen, ledgers, sort of accounting records type deal. They're all felony counts, but they're the lowest level felony offense under New York state law. And to prove Trump guilty, they don't only have to prove that these records were false. Prosecutors also have to prove that he acted in a way intending to defraud and intending to commit or further another crime. And so the challenge here is going to be proving not that, you know, the books were cooked, but that he was acting in order to cover up another crime that he or one of the people working with him committed.
I think that's such an important explanation, because a lot of times, my understanding is these types of charges would actually be misdemeanor charges, but they are, of course, bumped up to a felony because of exactly what you said, which is the prosecution is going to try and prove basically that the falsification of business records was done in order to try and for Trump to try and commit or conceal another crime. And I want to get into the details of that particular kind of legal jump. But before we do, could you highlight again for listeners, when it comes to the falsification of business records, and you talked about this a little bit, but I think people know broadly, this case is about Stormy Daniels. It's about hush money payments to her. It's about Michael Cohen. Could you give us the key facts in terms of what are actually the business records that were supposedly falsified and how?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you were saying, you know, the case at its core is around this $130,000 hush money payment that Michael Cohen made to Stormy Daniels ahead of the 2016 election. The records that we're looking at here are Cohen's invoices for legal fees. After he paid Stormy Daniels, he invoiced requesting legal fees for the hush money payment. But what prosecutors say is that calling those legal fees is not lawful. Trump sort of comes into the picture with the checks reimbursing Cohen, and then in the ledger entries that document those reimbursements in the Trump Organization's accounting records. So it's sort of this threefold, there are 34 counts, so, you know, 34 records, but it's sort of these threefold categories that we're looking at here.
That's really helpful. And so is the crux of it, essentially, Michael Cohen makes a payment to Stormy Daniels, Trump repays, and Trump says that he's paying for legitimate legal services. He does not say, I am paying to reimburse and give a little bonus on top of these hush money payments.
Yeah, that's right. And what we're going to see at trial is that prosecutors are going to attempt to sort of put this specific hush money payment into a bigger picture. It's like a smaller piece of a bigger puzzle. And that sort of leans into that idea that there were other crimes being concealed by calling this payment a legal fee.
So where we are at this point is if you just pay somebody a hush money payment, that in and of itself is not illegal. And so kind of step one of illegality, as I understand and as I understand you saying, is the fact that these payments are not coded correctly. It's not really legal fees to Michael Cohen. It's in fact really payments to reimburse Michael Cohen. And that where we now step into that hurdle of how do we go from a misdemeanor to a felony is really talking about what the purpose behind the payments were. And I understand the theory to be that the purpose was either to commit election law violations or tax law violations. And then the next step is, are we talking about federal violations or state violations? But is that also your understanding that we're talking about these two buckets? One is election law and the other is basically tax evasion.
Yeah, that's right. And the really important context here, obviously, is this is right before the 2016 election. Trump is a presidential candidate, and these stories are not necessarily flattering. And so part of the prosecution's story that they're going to be telling jurors here is that these payments were recategorized in a way that would make it easier to conceal from voters, essentially, these sort of engagements that the former president had.
So the idea is these aren't payments that you made to Stormy Daniels 2 years, 6 months before the election, where we could argue that maybe the purpose is to try and make sure that Melania doesn't find out about an alleged affair. But because of the timing, because the payments come, I believe, right after the Access Hollywood tape, that this is really about payments made in furtherance of the election. And that's where you get that hook to election laws and campaign finance laws. And that's where the prosecution is going to have to show this was basically a contribution to the candidate committee. Is that the thread that you think prosecutors are looking at here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, like I, you know, said, Stormy Daniels is just one piece of this puzzle that they are sort of looking at. So there are two other, you know, so-called catch and kill schemes where we have Trump, or Cohen rather, making payments to sort of have these unflattering stories about Trump be concealed. And when you put that into the context of the 2016 election and how they're being sort of misrepresented in the Trump Organization's records, that's where you sort of have this gray area of illegality.
So that's really helpful. And we're going to be looking at how the prosecution does hook these payments to potential violations of election laws. And then separately, I know there's been some talk about the idea that maybe there are tax issues here, and that the payments were made in part to try and avoid tax laws. Is that still a live issue in the trial, as you understand it?
Yeah, so that's something that was explained sort of in the statement of facts that the prosecutors put out at when the indictment came out. And so that's something that I expect we'll hear about at trial as well.
So it does seem like when it comes to this case, it takes a while to explain it. And in my experience, the longer it takes to explain, sometimes the more hurdles there are for the prosecutors. In your reporting, do you see, as far as you can tell, kind of some specific thresholds here where you think this is a place where I'm really going to look as a reporter to see how the prosecution clears this hurdle?
Yeah. So the big one is going to be linking these false classifications or allegedly false classifications to the secondary laws that were allegedly broken. And so obviously, you know, we are all well familiar with the story about the payment. We know that Michael Cohen paid Stormy Daniels. We know that, the doorman was paid by media executives to for his story about an allegedly illegitimate child from Trump. We know about Karen McDougal, but what we don't know and what prosecutors will have to prove is that those instances were being intentionally hidden by Trump and his allies so that they could either, you know, win the election, violate election laws to do so, or to gain some sort of tax benefit by classifying these payments differently. And so I think that that's probably the primary hurdle. In addition, we've got some witnesses who I think the defense is going to have, you know, a fun time knocking around. You know, Michael Cohen in particular has sort of gained a reputation as someone whose testimony is maybe not entirely accurate all the time. He recently testified in the former president's civil fraud trial. And while, you know, he testified that he sort of reverse engineered Trump's assets to engorge his net worth, he also on cross-examination sort of backtracked that entire statement. And, you know, we have a federal judge in a separate case saying that that was potentially perjury when he said that he did not really want to plead guilty to the crimes that he previously pleaded guilty to. And he's also just a polarizing figure. And so I think that prosecutors are going to have a hard time, I think, convincing a jury that this is a witness to be relied upon. And he really is at the sort of core of their case.
Right. So I completely agree with you. Those are the two places that I'm looking at as well. And before we get to Michael Cohen, although I think, frankly, we already covered Michael Cohen. He's gotten more than enough airtime. I want to go back to a word that you used when you were describing how we move from misdemeanors to felonies. And you said, use the word intent or intentionally. And can you highlight for us, what do the prosecutors actually have to show when it comes to intent? Does Trump, for instance, have to know that when he's paying Michael Cohen back and he's saying it's a legal payment and it's really not, that he's doing it this way in order to try and sway the election and make a campaign contribution that, if it's $130,000, is obviously way over the limit of, at the time, $2,700, and is not disclosed as is required by federal law? Do they have to show that he's, as he's making the payment, he's saying, yes, I know that I am violating federal election law, or, you know, another fork in the road, state election law?
Yeah, so there's a big difference between, you know, accidentally classifying something incorrectly and intentionally classifying something incorrectly to achieve an unlawful benefit. And so in this case, prosecutors need to show that Trump not only, you know, classified his payments to Cohen in one way, but also that in doing so, he knew that he would be benefiting in a way that was unlawful. And this is something I think is going to be a big challenge for the state.
Right. Because in so many ways, I think Trump has avoided accountability by saying, I didn't know or I didn't intend. And that will be, as we've been talking about, a threshold or hurdle in the case. Now, we talked about some questions for the prosecution. In your reporting, do you see places where you think maybe the defense might have a hard time poking holes in the argument, where you think, based on what we know now, that these are really strong pockets for the prosecution?
Sure. So I think one of the challenges here is that, you know, not to bring Michael Cohen back into the picture, but he's already been convicted of a separate crime in connection with this sort of these payments. And right. So already having that as sort of the ground level when you head into trial does give the prosecution a bit of a leg up, because they're able to point to his guilty plea and put him on the stand where he can talk about it and say, you know, here is a crime. Here's an example of something that was covered up. He admitted to it. And the defense will have to find a way to sort of talk their way around that. I think something else is, you know, this is going to be decided by a jury, and former President Trump is a very polarizing person. And so I think that jury selection is going to be absolutely paramount for both defense and prosecution, but particularly for the defense, because, you know, even if they can convince one juror that he's innocent, that is a win, I think, in their book.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a point that bears repeating, not only as you and I have talked about on and off air, the importance of jury selection, but that, of course, in our criminal justice system, if you can convince one juror that they have some doubt and that they can't convict and can't say that there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, then that's the end of this case. And we can all imagine what the former president will say if the jury fails to convict when it comes to this particular case, which again, I think is being asked to bear more weight, frankly, than it should, because it's the first one to go forward. Is there something that you wish people knew going into the trial, that you wish people understood a little bit better about what this case is really about?
I think one of the things that frequently gets swept under the rug in sort of the salaciousness of this case. Obviously, you know, we have Stormy Daniels, we have Karen McDougal, we have the doormen with all of these extremely sort of flashy stories about the former president accusing him of things that, you know, were not necessarily flattering for him. But I think at its core here, you know, this is right before an election. And I think what prosecutors are really going to try to hammer home is this is not just the former president, you know, acting in a way that maybe some would find unsavory. This was done with an intent to, or allegedly done with an intent to sway you, you know, sway the jurors, sway New York voters. And I think that that's something that we can expect to see really hammered home on their side of things.
Yeah, I think it's going to be so important for the prosecution to be able to make some version of an argument that this is an election interference case, just like the case in D.C. and the case in Georgia are also election interference cases. Those cases were about the end of the 2020 election. This case is about the beginning of the 2016 election. And even though the charges are different, the idea is very broadly the same. So it will be really interesting to follow that trial. And I know that people will be following your reporting in The Hill. Before I let you go, I also know you've been covering one of the other election interference trials, the one out of Georgia. And can you remind us what is the latest in that case? Because I think for a lot of people, the latest was actually the disqualification hearing regarding District Attorney Fannie Willis. And I kind of fear, frankly, that that's paramount in our mind when we think about that case, even though it, of course, had nothing to do with the charges against Trump and whether or not those were appropriate or not. Can you give us a little bit of a refresher? What are we waiting for on that case?
Yeah. So what aren't we waiting for on that case? There are a lot of things going on in Georgia all the time. I think you're absolutely right that the disqualification situation sort of delayed and derailed that case for several weeks. It absolutely sucked the air out of anything else that was going on in connection with other defendants or the actual charges. So just to sort of give a little bit of a rundown as to what's been going on lately, the most recent thing that happened has nothing to do with Trump and to do with Georgia's lieutenant governor, Burt Jones, who was recently assigned a prosecutor to the case. So Fannie Willis actually was disqualified from prosecuting his case after she held a fundraiser for a Democratic candidate who eventually faced off with Jones in his race for lieutenant governor. The judge overseeing that described that whole situation as a "what are you thinking" moment with Fannie Willis. For 21 months, nobody was prosecuting Burt Jones's case in particular. But as of, I think, yesterday, all the days mixed together, I think as of yesterday, the executive director of the prosecuting attorneys council of Georgia, Pete Scandalous tasked himself with the probe. And so that's finally going forward in one way or another. Relating to Trump, the most recent thing to happen is that Judge McAfee rejected his arguments that his charges should be dismissed on First Amendment grounds. That's something that we sort of saw coming. The same argument was rejected with Kenneth Chesebro earlier this year, or I guess last year before he pleaded guilty in the case. And so that essentially means that, you know, Trump's arguments that the case against him is invalid because he was just using his First Amendment right to speak out, it doesn't hold water. And so they've asked to appeal that. The judge hasn't decided on whether he'll let them appeal it. But if he does, then that will go to the appeals court in Georgia, where Trump's appeal on the disqualification ruling is already sort of waiting on a decision.
So we are, I mean, you gave a great answer, which is, what are we not waiting on? Which now I guess I'll ask you the question I get asked a lot, and maybe not my favorite question, but it's a fair one, which is, in your reporting, do you have a sense of, after the New York hush money payment trial goes, which will be, I think the estimates are about 6 weeks. Let's imagine that that wraps up the first week of June. Let's imagine that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that there is not absolute immunity, which with some wrinkles could allow the DC election interference case to move forward. Do you have a sense of whether or not we're going to see another trial before the November election?
It's a tough question for a good reason. You know, I think that everybody is sort of wondering where things stand with Trump's other cases. And I think that the answer is that we really just don't know. I think it's certainly possible that the election interference case in DC could go forward. That really depends on Judge Chutkan in DC, whether she decides to sort of expedite that pretrial schedule and get things going this fall or early or late summer, or if she decides that there's just not enough time to put on a trial before the election. There's also the idea that, you know, the Justice Department sort of has this unspoken rule about not prosecuting cases within a certain time frame before the election regarding candidates. And so, you know, is that something that they continue to abide by in a case like this? We don't know. In Florida, that case seems as if it will be delayed as well. And then in Georgia, we don't have a trial date yet. So I think it's unlikely that that case will head to trial this year either, even though state prosecutors have asked for it to start in August.
And there we go. One trial likely to start, in my estimation, at least before the election. I think you're exactly, I also agree, it really depends on what happens in the Supreme Court and what happens in Judge Chutkan's chambers and in her courtroom as a result, meaning will there be any sort of immunity granted to the former president. And we're still waiting on a separate Supreme Court decision involving the obstruction statute that he's partly charged under, and a question as to whether or not that's an appropriate statute to use here. So there'll be a lot for us to watch. As I said, I will continue to follow your reporting to make sure that I stay up to date and educated on all of this. So, Ella Lee, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much. Great talking with you.